Chapter 17. Style of beauty I don't care for. Apostrophe apostrophe oh, if 'tis only looks you are thinking of, apostrophe said the miller, much relieved, there's nothing to be said, of course. Though there's many a duchess worse looking, if it comes to argument, as you would find, my son, apostrophe he added, with a sense of having been mollified too soon. The mate's thoughts were elsewhere by this time. As to my marrying Matilda, thinks I, here's one of the very genteelest sort, and I may as well do the job at once. So I chose her. She's a dear girl, there's nobody like her, search where you will. Apostrophe apostrophe, how many did you choose her out from? Apostrophe apostrophe inquired his father. Well, she was the only young woman I happened to know in Southampton, that's true. But what of that? It would have been all the same, if I had known 100. Apostrophe apostrophe, her father is in business near the docks, I suppose? Apostrophe apostrophe, well, no. In short, I didn't see her father. Apostrophe, her mother? Apostrophe apostrophe, her mother? No, I didn't. I think her mother is dead. But as he has got a very rich aunt living at Melchester. I didn't see her aunt, because there wasn't time to go, but of course we shall know her when we are married. Apostrophe apostrophe, yes, yes, of course, apostrophe said the miller, trying to feel quite satisfied. And she will soon be here? Apostrophe, eh, she's coming soon, apostrophe said Bob. As he has gone to this aunt's at Melchester, to get her things packed, and such like, or she would have come with me. I am going to meet the coach at the King's Arms, Casterbridge, on Sunday, at 1 o'clock. To show what a capital sort of wife she'll be, I may tell you, that she wanted to come by the Mercury, because 'tis a little cheaper than the other. But I said, for once in your life do it well, and come by the Royal Mail, and I'll pay. I can have the pony and trap to fetch her, I suppose, as 'tis too far for her to walk? Apostrophe apostrophe, of course you can, Bob, or anything else. And I'll do all I can to give you a good wedding feast. Apostrophe apostrophe, XVI. They make ready for the illustrious stranger, preparations for Matilda's welcome, and for the event which was to follow, at once occupied the attention of the mill. The miller and his man had but dim notions of housewifery on any large scale. So the great wedding cleaning was kindly supervised by Mrs. Garland, Bob being mostly away during the day with his brother, the trumpet major, on various errands, one of which was to buy paint and varnish for the gig that Matilda was to be fetched in, which he had determined to decorate with his own hands. By the widow's direction, the old familiar incrustation of shining dirt, imprinted along the back of the settle by the heads of countless jolly sitters, was scrubbed and scraped away, the brown circle round the nail whereon the miller hung his hat, stained by the brim in wet weather, was whitened over, the tawny smudges of bygone shoulders in the passage were removed without regard to a certain genial and historical value which they had acquired. The face of the clock, coated with verdigris as thick as a diachylon plaster, was rubbed till the figures emerged in 2 days, while, inside the case of the same chronometer, the cobwebs that formed triangular hammocks, which the pendulum could hardly wade through, were cleared away at one swoop. Mrs. Garland also assisted at the invasion of worm-eaten cupboards, where layers of ancient smells lingered on in the stagnant air, and recalled to the reflective nose the many good things that had been kept there. The upper floors were scrubbed with such abundance of water that the old established death watches, wood lice, and flower worms were all drowned, the suds trickling down into the room below in so lively and novel a manner as to convey the romantic notion that the miller lived in a cave with dripping stalactites. They moved what had never been moved before, the oak coffer, containing the miller's wardrobe a tremendous weight, what with its locks, hinges, nails, dirt, framework, and the hard stratification of old jackets, waistcoats, and knee breeches at the bottom, never disturbed since the miller's wife died, and half pulverized by the moths, whose flattened skeletons lay amid the mass in thousands. It fairly makes my back open and shut. Apostrophe apostrophe said Loveday, as, in obedience to Mrs. Garland's direction, he lifted one corner, the grinder and David assisting at the others. All together. Speak when he be going to heave. Now. Apostrophe, the pot covers and skimmers were brought to such a state that, on examining them, the beholder was not conscious of utensils, but of his own face in a condition of hideous elasticity. The broken clock line was mended, the kettles rocked, the creeper nailed up, and a new handle put to the warming pan. The large household lantern was cleaned out, after 3 years of uninterrupted accumulation. The operation yielding a conglomerate of candle snuffs, candle ends, remains of matches, lamp black, and 11 ounces and a half of good grease invaluable as dubbing for skiddy boots and ointment for cartwheels. Everybody said that the mill residence had not been so thoroughly scoured for 20 years. The miller and David looked on with a sort of awe tempered by gratitude, tacitly admitting by their gaze that this was beyond what they had ever thought of. Mrs. Garland supervised all with disinterested benevolence. It would never have done, she said, for his future daughter-in-law, to see the house in its original state. She would have taken a dislike to him, and perhaps to Bob likewise. Why don't he come, and live here with me, and then you would be able to see to it at all times? Apostrophe apostrophe said the miller as she bustled about again. To which she answered, that she was considering the matter, and might in good time. He had previously informed her, that his plan was to put Bob, and his wife in the part of the house that she, Mrs. Garland, occupied, as soon as she chose to enter his, which relieved her of any fear of being incommoded by Matilda. The cooking for the wedding festivities was on a proportionate scale of thoroughness. They killed the 4 supernumerary chickens that had just begun to crow, and the little curly-tailed barrow pig, in preference to the sow, not having been put up fattening for more than 5 weeks. It was excellent small meat, and therefore more delicate and likely to suit a town-bred lady's taste than the large one, which, having reached the weight of 80, might have been a little gross to a cultured palate. There were also provided a cold chine, stuffed veal, and 2 pigeon pies. Also 30 rings of black pot, a dozen of white pot, and 10 knots of tender and well-washed chitterlings, cooked plain in case she should like a change. As additional reserves there were sweetbreads, and 5 milts, sewed up at one side in the form of a chrysalis, and stuffed with thyme, sage, parsley, mint, groats, rice, milk, chopped egg, and other ingredients. They were afterwards roasted before a slow fire, and eaten hot. The business of chopping so many herbs for the various stuffings was found to be aching work for women, and David, the miller, the grinder, and the grinder's boy being fully occupied in their proper branches, and Bob being very busy painting the gig and touching up the harness, Loveday called in a friendly dragoon of John's regiment who was passing by, and he, being a muscular man, willingly chopped all the afternoon for a quart of strong, judiciously administered, and all other victuals found. Taking off his jacket and gloves, rolling up his shirt sleeves and unfastening his collar in an honorable and energetic way. All windfalls and maggot cord codlins were excluded from the apple pies, and as there was no known dish large enough for the purpose, the puddings were stirred up in the milking pail, and boiled in the 3-legged bell metal crock, of great weight and antiquity, which every traveling tinker for the previous 30 years had tapped with his stick, coveted, made a bid for, and often attempted to steal. In the liquor line Loveday laid in an ample barrel of Casterbridge strong beer. Apostrophe apostrophe this renowned drink now almost as much a thing of the past as Falstaff's favorite beverage was not only well calculated to win the hearts of soldiers blown dry and moldy by residence in tents on a hilltop, but of any wayfarer whatever in that land. It was of the most beautiful color that the eye of an artist in beer could desire, full in body, yet brisk as a volcano, piquant, yet without a twang, luminous as an autumn sunset, free from streakiness of taste, But, finally, rather Eddie. The masses worshipped it, the minor gentry loved it more than wine, and by the most illustrious county families it was not despised. Anybody brought up for being drunk and disorderly in the streets of its natal borough had only to prove that he was a stranger to the place and its liquor to be honorably dismissed by the magistrates as one overtaken in a fault that no man could guard against who entered the town unawares. In addition, Mr. Loveday also tapped a hogshead of fine cider that he had had mellowing in the house for several months, having bought it of an honest down countryman, who did not color for any special occasion like the present. It had been pressed from fruit judiciously chosen by an old hand horner and Cleves apple for the body, a few tom putts for color, and just a dash of old five corners for sparkle, a selection originally made to please the palate of a well-known temperate earl who was a regular cider drinker, and lived to be 88. On the morning of the Sunday appointed for her coming, Captain Bob Loveday set out to meet his bride. He had been all the week engaged in painting the gig, assisted by his brother at odd times, and it now appeared of a gorgeous yellow, with blue streaks, and tassels at the corners, and red wheels outlined with a darker shade. He put in the pony at 11:30, and looking at him from the door as he packed himself into the vehicle and drove off. There may be young women who look out at young men driving to meet their brides as Anne looked at Captain Bob, and yet are quite indifferent to the circumstances, but they are not often met with. So much dust had been raised on the highway by traffic resulting from the presence of the court at the town further on, that brambles hanging from the fence, and giving a friendly scratch to the wanderer's face, were dingy as church cobwebs, and the grass on the margin had assumed a paper shaving hue. Bob's father had wished him to take David, lest, from want of recent experience at the whip, he should meet with any mishap, but, picturing to himself the awkwardness of three in such circumstances, Bob would not hear of this, and nothing more serious happened to his driving than that the wheel marks formed two serpentine lines along the road during the first mile or two, before he had got his hand in, and that the horse shied at a milestone, a piece of paper, a sleeping tramp, and a wheelbarrow, just to make use of the opportunity of being in bad hands. He entered Casterbridge between 12 and 1, and, putting up at the old Greyhound, walked onto the Bow. Here, rather moldy on the ledges of his clothes, he stood and waited, while the people in their best summer dresses poured out of the three churches round him. When they had all gone, and a smell of cinders and gravy had spread down the ancient high street, and the pie dishes from adjacent bakehouses had all travelled past, he saw the mail coach rise above the arch of Gray's Bridge, a quarter of a mile distant, surmounted by swaying knobs, which proved to be the heads of the outside travellers. "That's the way for a man's bride to come to him," apostrophe said Robert to himself with a feeling of poetry, and as the horn sounded and the horses clattered up the street he walked down to the inn. The knot of hostlers and inn servants had gathered, the horses were dragged from the vehicle, and the passengers for Casterbridge began to descend. Captain Bob eyed them over, looked inside, looked outside again. To his disappointment, Matilda was not there, nor her boxes, nor anything that was hers. Neither coachman nor guard had seen or heard of such a person at Melchester, and Bob walked slowly away. Depressed by forebodings to an extent which took away nearly a third of his appetite, he sat down in the parlor of the old Greyhound to a slice from the family joint of the landlord. This gentleman, who dined in his shirt sleeves, partly because it was August, and partly from a sense that they would not be so fit for public view further on in the week, suggested that Bob should wait till 3 or 4 that afternoon, when the road wagon would arrive, as the lost lady might have preferred that mode of conveyance. And when Bob appeared rather hurt at the suggestion, the landlord's wife assured him, as a woman who knew good life, that many genteel persons travelled in that way during the present high price of provisions. Loveday, who knew little of travelling by land, readily accepted her assurance and resolved to wait. wandering up and down the pavement, or leaning against some odd wall between the wagon office and the corner of the street above, he passed the time away. It was a still, sunny, drowsy afternoon, and scarcely a soul was visible in the length and breadth of the street. The office was not far from All Saints Church, and the church windows being open, he could hear the afternoon service from where he lingered as distinctly as if he had been one of the congregation. Thus he was mentally conducted through the Psalms, through the first and second lessons, through the burst of fiddles and clarionets which announced the evening hymn, and well into the sermon, before any signs of the wagon could be seen upon the London road. The afternoon sermons at this church, being of a dry and metaphysical nature at that date, it was by a special providence that the wagon office was placed near the ancient fabric, so that whenever the Sunday wagon was late, which it always was in hot weather, in cold weather, in wet weather, and in weather of almost every other sort, the rattle, dismounting, and swearing outside completely drowned the parson's voice within, and sustained the flagging interest of the congregation at precisely the right moment. No sooner did the charity children begin to writhe on their benches, and adult snores grow audible, than the wagon arrived. Captain Loveday felt a kind of sinking in his poetry at the possibility of her for whom they had made such preparations being in the slow unwieldy vehicle which crunched its way towards him, but he would not give in to the weakness. Neither would he walk down the street to meet the wagon, lest she should not be there. At last the broad wheels drew up against the curb, the wagoner with his white smock frock, and whip as long as a fishing line, descended from the pony on which he rode alongside, and the six broad-chested horses backed from their collars and shook themselves. In another moment something showed forth, and he knew that Matilda was there. Bob felt three cheers rise within him as she stepped down, but it being Sunday he did not utter them. In dress, Miss Johnson passed his expectations a green and white gown, with long, tight sleeves, a green silk handkerchief round her neck and crossed in front, a green parasol, and green gloves. It was strange enough to see this verdant caterpillar turn out of a road wagon, and gracefully shake herself free from the bits of straw and fluff which would usually gather on the raiment of the grandest travelers by that vehicle. "But, my dear Matilda," apostrophe said Bob, when he had kissed her three times with much publicity the practical step he had determined on seeming to demand, "that these things should no longer be done in a corner, my dear Matilda, why didn't you come by the coach, having the money for it and all?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe, that's my scrimping." "Apostrophe, apostrophe," said Matilda in a delightful gush. "I know you won't be offended, when you know I did it to save against a rainy Gutenberg edition." End of chapter.